Morning. I shared this morning a little glimpse into Steve's life before I begin. I love the fact that we can come to God just as we are. I mean, how else will we come to Him? But for me, I'm a plodder in the morning. I really, really slow, slow transitioner. I don't know what it's got to do with old age or, you know, only two brain cells up there left. I don't. Post-traumatic stress syndrome, spiritual warfare, not enough coffee. I have no clue what that's about, especially when I'm preaching. And this morning was no exception to that. So I get really disoriented. I lose my compass. It's kind of like trying to catch a feather in a dust storm, you know, for me to get centered. Last night, the family had a very, very busy night. My daughter was a susical, musical. She was so cute. But we got to sleep really late. And I kind of knew that was going to happen, so I called Pat yesterday, I think that was. That was yesterday, right? Okay. And gave her a warning. Hey, I'm preaching tomorrow. I may be a little late. So, oh, Lord. And then I got to sleep probably about 1 o'clock last night. And then this morning that storm hit. Did y'all hear that storm?
Yes.
Foster City. Hopefully y'all heard it. And the wind was like blowing. 5 o'clock this morning, I woke up out of a sound sleep. And I'm a deep sleeper. Maybe that's one reason why I have a hard time kind of transitioning in the morning. I don't know. That's another thought. I'll take that to prayer. But, you know, that wind started blowing, and I woke up, and I really didn't know where I was. I didn't know whether I was awake or asleep or whether God had transported me to Kansas to be with Dorothy and Toto. You know, I still don't know. So, that's a little glimpse into my life. You probably would be surprised, too, that I've always been the kind of person who's pretty much found trouble virtually around every corner. That's probably surprising news for some of you. And even as a kid, you know, I fell a little bit on the mischievous side of things. I thought it was hilarious to watch my older brother's face as he slipped into sheets at night only to find a generous lathering of Dad's shaving cream there. And, you know, despite his, like, pleadings and warnings, I continue to do it again and again. I don't treat him like that anymore. Only on his birthdays. Now, he may be my older brother, but I'm bigger than he is. You know, the other thing is I think I was a pretty courageous kid, too, at least in my own mind. When my friends would dare me to jump off a construction site onto gravel pit like two stories below, my response was like, watch me. And there I went, you know, flying like Superman, tickle pink at the opportunity to prove them wrong. And then there were times that I think I was pretty stubborn and downright compulsive. Although my wife would probably tell you I'm still like that today. Growing up in San Francisco, Mom and Dad used to tell my older brother and me to stay away from certain areas of the city. Don't go to Chinatown, they'd say. Too much gang activity there. You know, stay away from downtown areas where the, you know, the homeless and the bums hang their hats. And on, you know, moms and pops are. But the one prohibition that rankled me the most was when they would tell us to stay away from the Palace of Fine Arts. I mean, that was incredible to me. But you got to understand, in that day, the palace was still, it was yet to be reconstructed into what we have today. The Exploratorium was an old Muni bus barn. That whole place was surrounded by very, very tall fences with large signs that read in bold letters like, no trespassing. You know, plaster could and would fall from the decaying structures at any time. I mean, the whole place was infested with weeds, garden snakes, snails and duck poop. We always imagine evil groundskeepers lurking within the palace, you know, just waiting to chase us away from our very own private fort. But despite all the concerns, all the warnings, where do you think I ended up? Yeah, time and time again, man. You know, trouble found me virtually around every corner. Kind of followed me in adult life, still today. Probably more accurately, I found it. So when we come to Acts chapters 21, 22, we're continuing in our series with Acts today. And I'm going to really need to summarize a lot of these verses. This is a very big passage that we're going to be looking at today. We find the Apostle Paul in similar circumstances. Hey, he's in trouble. And as much as I appreciate Paul's discernment, his prayer life, his passion for God's word and the Spirit's direction in his life, Paul was also a bit compulsive. You know, he's hard-headed at times. It's not to say that he was headstrong in the same way that I was as a kid. But to say that Paul was merely a man of great conviction would be an understatement. Paul was driven. And when he set his sights towards Jerusalem, nothing was going to deter him from arriving at that destination, regardless of the many pleadings and warnings that he'd received along the way. I mean, really. Because he had a heart to reach Israel. Because he saw an opportunity in the gathering of the Jews at the day of Pentecost, Paul resolved to go there. Not only to be bound, but to die for the cause of Christ, if that be God's will for him. Now, once in Jerusalem, Paul received much approval from James and the elders of the church there. They were also very much appreciative of the generous offering that he had brought with them from the Gentile churches. But there were also concerns. A rumor had been spreading amongst the Jewish Christians that Paul was teaching against the law of Moses. Of course, this was false. Paul never taught the Jews to abandon Moses or to not circumcise their children. What he taught was that the Gentiles should not be subject to these Jewish provisions. So when Paul became aware of all this prattle, I mean, he could have responded by defending his position. That's probably the way that I would have reacted. He had been misunderstood. These accusations were so unfair. These people obviously didn't know what they were talking about. But instead, Paul demonstrated his great character by simply listening to and submitting underneath a plan to allay these suspicions. Paul took it upon himself to go into the temple with four young men who were taking a vow to God and underwrite their expenses until they completed the purification rites as prescribed by law. Now, some scholars would say that Paul was wrong in placing himself back under the law, while others say that he was just following his established practices. Personally, I respect the fact that Paul was secure enough in Christ that when he was with the Jews, he became as a Jew. Now, that doesn't bug me a bit. Likewise, when he was ministering to the Gentiles, he became as a Gentile. He probably listened to hard rock music or something. You know, when he was with the weak, he limited himself in order to connect with that culture and not be a stumbling block to the gospel message. I apply the same principle when teaching at Higher Power. Because that culture is primarily unchurched, I tone down the Christianese. You know, I wear jeans, t-shirts. I use slang like dude and bro. We talk about the 12-step process. That's a language they understand. Okay? When Pat Portman takes her women to Romania, they strip off their makeup and their jewelry so as to not offend the cultural sensitivities there. This is not a salvation issue. This is just smart evangelism. So for the same reason, Paul here is participating in these Jewish customs so that whatever rumors to the contrary might be silenced through his conciliatory actions. And it's during this process, Luke tells us that the duck poop hit the fan. The trouble began when some Jews, in recognizing Paul in the temple, incited a riot against him. Now, this is a scene like out of the Wild Wild West, really. These were not the Christian Jews from the Jerusalem church, but a group of non-Christian Jews from Asia, probably Ephesus. They had been seen, you know, over the years, their following dwindled in size as thousands of people, their following, had turned to Christ through Paul's ministry. As a result, they longed to get rid of Paul. That makes sense to me. And now that chance had come, for Paul was on their turf. So they inflamed the worshiping crowd with two trumped-up charges. The first was that Paul was anti-Semitic. He was accused of teaching against our people and our law and this place. The second was that Paul had brought Greeks into the temple, which by law would defile it. Evidently, they had seen a man by the name of Trophimus with Paul earlier in the city and jumped to the conclusion that Paul had also brought him into the inner temple, which was forbidden to Gentiles. Gentiles were allowed in the outer court. The inner courts were only permissible to Jews. Some years ago, an archaeologist actually found a copper plaque that had been fixed on the wall dividing the two courts. It warned, "No Gentile shall enter within the partition and barrier surrounding the temple, and whoever is caught shall be responsible to himself for his subsequent death." That's pretty gnarly. Now, Paul was surely aware of this prohibition and would never have endangered his friend in that way. Besides, he was already showing his respect for the ceremonial laws by participating in the purification ritual. So it makes no sense that he would violate the temple precincts by bringing in a Gentile. False or not, these accusations soon spread like fire. A lynch mob seized Paul. They drug him out of the inner court by the scruff of his neck and basically began to beat him to death. And they probably would have succeeded if God had not intervened through the Roman soldiers who were stationed along the outer wall. Seeing the ruckus, these soldiers sent word to their commander, a man by the name of Claudius Lysias, who immediately gathered his centurions, charged down into the crowd and rescued Paul. And once he had Paul in his possession, the commander then attempted to find out from the crowd who Paul is and, hey, actually, what had he done? But there was such a frenzy that some of them were saying one thing and others were saying something else. They were pretty confused. So he concluded that the best thing was to take Paul inside the barracks and interrogate him personally. And as he started to take Paul away, the mob followed, shouting, "Away with him! Away with him!" I just want to stop just for a second right here and ask you to put yourself in Paul's shoes. How difficult, how heartbreaking it must have been to face the sting of rejection that sprang from those words. Paul had been accused. He'd been abused. And now he'd been abandoned by the very people he had come to serve. In the first part of Romans 9, we get a sense of what this must have meant for Paul. He writes, "I have great sorrow and unceasing grief in my heart, for I could wish that I myself were cursed, separated from Christ for the sake of my brethren, my kinsmen, according to the flesh, who are Israelites." Get a sense of his heart. Paul, as a Jew, loved his people. Never make a mistake about that. He loved their common heritage. He loved all the rituals that ultimately pointed towards the one who would fulfill every word of what those ceremonies stood for. And he longed to reach them. Yet his heart was broken when he saw the bitterness and the opposition for the cause to which he now stood. Do you think it brought Paul any consolation to know that these very words, away with him, away with him, were also hurled at Jesus at the point of his crucifixion, that in some surreal way, he was indeed following in Christ's stead. I mean, they didn't mean take him away from the temple area. They meant remove him from the earth. Paul was never closer to death than at this point. His own people's hatred was so fierce that the soldiers themselves had to hoist Paul upon his shoulders, their shoulders, as they moved him away from the temple courts and into protective custody. Can you imagine? Let's pick up Paul's great response, his apologetic, in Acts 21, starting in verse 37. But as Paul was about to be brought in the barracks, he said to the commander, "May I say something to you?" And the commander said, "Do you know Greek? Then you are not the Christian, the Egyptian, who some time ago stirred up a revolt, led the 4,000 men of the assassins out in the wilderness." But Paul said, "I am a Jew of Tarsus in Cilicia, a citizen of no insignificant city, and I beg you, allow me to speak to the people." And when he had given him permission, Paul, standing on the stairs, motioned to the people with his hand. And when there was a great hush, he spoke to them in the Hebrew dialect, saying, "Brethren, fathers, hear my defense, which I now offer to you." And when they heard that he was addressing them in the Hebrew dialect, they became even more quiet. Initially, what we see in this little section is that we have a case of mistaken identity. The commander actually thought that Paul was somebody else. An Egyptian who a few years earlier had led a band of desperados to the Mount of Olives and promised that when the walls of Jerusalem came tumbling down at his command, they would then be able to break in the city and overrun the Romans. Of course, he was unable to deliver on his promise. The Romans came and made short work of them, but the Egyptian himself had escaped. So when the commander heard the cultured accents of Greece flowing from Paul's lips, he knew that Paul was no assassin. So the Jews believed Paul to be a blasphemous teacher. The Romans thought he was an Egyptian terrorist. How confusing it must have been. But despite the ridiculous allegations, Paul again responds calmly, asks the commander if he could speak to the crowd who's still calling out for his death. When he received permission, Paul addressed the crowd in their own language by using the Hebrew dialect of Aramaic and calling them brethren and fathers. He was identifying with the people. This is so important. For here's the first door that has to be opened in ministering to those who stand in opposition to our faith. We have to ask ourselves, how can we speak their language? I've already mentioned the fact that when I speak to ex-cons and recovering addicts, my language, my style of talking is a little bit different than what I'm using today. The message is the same, but the way in which it can best be heard, received, digested is the guiding principle here. So by using their native language, the crowds are becoming a little more receptive. And that's the point, what Paul has to say. As he continued in his efforts to win a hearing among them, Paul then gave his BC, or before conversion, credentials. "I am a Jew born in Tarsus of Cilicia," he told them, "but brought up in this city, educated under Gamaliel, strictly according to the law of our fathers, being zealous for God, just as you all are today. And I persecuted this way to the death, binding and putting both men and women into prisons, and also the high priests, and all the counsel of the elders can testify. From them I also received letters to the brethren, and started off for Damascus in order to bring even those who are there to Jerusalem to be punished." So Paul initially is stressing his Jewish heritage and his training under the highly respected Gamaliel, one of five Jewish rabbis regarded as the greatest of all time. He wanted to gain credibility with his audience by telling them of his common zeal for the law and his shared animosity of Christians. Those two things. Paul is basically saying, hey, I'm one of you. We share the same history. And this is the second door that has to be opened. You know, we should never, ever forget where we came from. And Paul here is, in one sense, wearing his shame as a badge of honor for the benefit of his hearers. Now, don't misunderstand. I'm not saying that his training and passion for God was without value. Every spiritual advantage before the coming of Christ was with the Jews, and Paul acknowledged that openly. But later in his epistles to the Philippians, where Paul is once again citing his before conversion credentials, he says he considers all of them as what? Rubbish. Literally food scraps or dung. So he might gain Christ. No amount of self-effort, no amount of training, no amount of zeal for the law mattered any longer for the surpassing value of knowing Christ. Put it to shame. I can relate to what he's saying. And I certainly appreciate what he's doing. And though my own history is different from Paul's, who best can identify with a particular culture than somebody who's been there, done that, and is not ashamed to admit it? You see, God uses our BC credentials to effectively connect to and minister to those who are still in bondage to that system. This, I believe, is Paul's point, one that then paves the way for the sharing of his salvation experience. And it came about that as I was on my way approaching Damascus about noontime, a very bright light suddenly flashed from heaven all around me, and I fell to the ground and heard a voice saying to me, Saul, Saul, why are you persecuting me? And I answered, who art thou, Lord? And he said to me, I am Jesus, the Nazarene, who you are persecuting. And those who were with me beheld the light, to be sure, but did not understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. And I said, what shall I do, Lord? And the Lord said to me, arise and go on into Damascus, and there you be told of all that has been appointed for you to do. But since I could not see because of the brightness of the light, I was led by the hand by those who were with me and came into Damascus. And a certain Ananias, a man who was devout by the standard of the law, well spoken of by all the Jews who lived there, came to me and standing said to me, Brother Saul, receive your sight. And at that very time I looked up at him. And he said, the God of our fathers has appointed you to know his will, to see the righteous one, and to hear an utterance from his mouth. For you will be a witness for him to all men of what you have seen and heard. And now why do you delay? Arise, be baptized, wash away your sins, calling or trusting on his name. This is Paul's salvation experience. It's packed with detail. But notice that Paul makes no effort or attempt to preach, but rather falls back on the most powerful form of witness, telling the story of what happened to him when God's light descended in the form of Jesus. And this is the third door that must be open if we are to reach hearts that may be lost or hardened to grace. Whenever we tell our stories, when we communicate how we had an encounter with a living God, which provided us with new perspectives, a new beginning, how he washed us clean and gave us a new desire to follow him. We are the world's greatest authority on that subject. Do you know that? It's true. And we don't have time to go through all the details of Paul's conversion, but what a wonderful effect this must have had upon the crowd who had never before heard it from his lips. And though it occurred some 30 years before, every detail is still etched within the memory of the Apostle Paul. He recalls it as vividly as if it were yesterday. I bet you can do the same thing. I certainly do. I remember that day. I will never forget that day. This was the moment he'd received new sight. His own calling as a witness had flowed out of this day. Ananias, whom Paul deliberately characterizes as a devout observer of the law, highly respected by all Jews, told him that the God of our fathers had chosen him to know his will, to hear his voice, and be his witness. And by relating these circumstances, Paul is turning the tables on his adversaries. He had acted and was acting in submission to divine initiative. It was a passive thing and not to any agenda of his own. Therefore, charging him, albeit falsely, would be the same as indicting God himself. His very testimony reinforced that point. It's as if he's implying very subtly, hey, if you have a problem with Jesus, you might want to take that up with God, not me. And this is so important for us to remember, those of us who are doing the ministering. When dealing with oppositional people, we can connect with their language and their histories. We can give our own accounting of how God miraculously intervened. But ultimately, the outcome and accountability rests where? Between them and God. We're but messengers. We can only put our experience on display to be accepted or rejected. Then Paul does a strange thing. He recounts a vision he received from the Lord some 27 years earlier when 3 years after his conversion, he came back to Jerusalem. Listen to this. And it came about when I returned to Jerusalem and was praying in the temple that I fell into a trance. And I saw him saying to me, make haste, get out of Jerusalem quickly because they will not accept your testimony about me. And I said, but Lord, they themselves understand. Then in one synagogue after another, I used to imprison and beat those who believed in thee. And when the blood of thy witness Stephen was being shed, I also was standing by approving and watching out for the cloaks of those who were slaying him. And he said to me, go, for I'll send you far away to the Gentiles. This is an interesting little piece right here. Paul came back to Jerusalem thinking that he was a self-appointed apostle to the nation of Israel. He believed that once the Jews saw the radical transformation in his life, they would then be convinced of the truth of the gospel. That makes sense. Perfect sense to me. But not only were his assumptions false, but even the Christians had difficulty receiving him. And the apostles would have little to do with him. Brokenhearted, Paul then went into the temple to pray when the Lord came to him and spoke to him. And in spite of his objections, Paul was told to leave Jerusalem immediately. Go, the Lord said, for I'm calling you to literally be an apostle to the Gentiles. And this is the final door that has to be open. We have to clearly communicate God's present calling in our lives in order to contrast the difference that Christ makes in our lives. Paul once terrorized Christians. Now he's their greatest advocate. Only Christ can rewire our desires in such a radical way. When Paul mentions this specific calling, all hell breaks loose again. And they listened to him up to this statement. Then they raised their voices and said, away with such a fellow from the earth, for he should not be allowed to live. And as they were crying out and throwing off their cloaks and tossing dust into the air, the commander ordered him to be brought into the barracks, stating that he should be examined by scourging so that he may find out the reason why they were shouting against him that way. And when they stretched him out with thongs, Paul said to the centurion who was standing by, hey, excuse me, Is it lawful for you to scourge a man who is a Roman and uncondemned? And when the centurion heard this, he went to the commander and told him, saying, what are you about to do? For this man is a Roman. And the commander came and said to him, tell me, are you a Roman? And he said, yes. And the commander answered, I acquired the citizenship with a large sum of money. And Paul said, but I was actually born a citizen. Therefore, those who were about to examine him immediately let go of him. And the commander also was afraid when he found out that he was a Roman, and because he had put him in chains. Now, Paul was probably not finished bringing these Jews up to speed with his story. Probably had a lot more to communicate to them. But in their mind, he was too through, as we say. What were they offended about? Well, they were offended by the suggestion that God could relate directly to the Gentiles through Christ. To their way of thinking, everyone else except themselves was unworthy of God's salvation. You see, theirs was the ultimate prejudice. The commander, now, not understanding anything that happened because it's all in Aramaic, was wondering what had reignited the flame. So he ordered Paul to be brought into the barracks to be examined through scourging. Now, this was a process of beating a man with leather thongs embedded with bits of metal and bone. I mean, if one didn't die from the scourge, they would most likely be crippled for life. But here again, we see Paul thinking on his feet. Knowing it was illegal for a Roman citizen to be bound and beaten, Paul invokes his citizenship. The law of Rome explicitly stated that no Roman was to be bound without due process of law. And though Christ had called Paul to suffer for his name, this didn't include needless suffering. So here we have God using the Roman justice system again to protect Paul from harm. You see, God wasn't finished with him. Not by a long shot. And though from this point on, the Apostle Paul will never again minister as a free man, still there were those in chains elsewhere in need of what he had to offer. He had yet to write his great prison epistles, his letters to the Ephesian church, to the church in Philippi, to Colossians, and to Philemon. Rome was still on the horizon of God's plans for him. Though Paul will remain a prisoner of Caesar, nonetheless, he'll carry out what remains of his ministry with power and blessing and renewed influence throughout the Roman Empire. What a wild story this is. What a great testimony. What a great heart for ministry. Now, as we stand back of this story and review it, I can't help but think of the phrase that Paul uses in 2 Corinthians, where he says, struck down, but not destroyed. Struck down, but not destroyed. Paul was assaulted from virtually every angle. But as we close this passage, he's still standing. Do you know that God will call us into situations at times where we too will be struck down by the very hands we're trying to serve? I mean, it's not a stretch of my imagination for me to go back into an unprotected prison environment to minister grace, only to receive much catcalls and disgrace. I know firsthand how hardened that culture can be. You too may encounter opposition, although it's real difficult for us to put ourselves in Paul's position over there. But you may find opposition in the academic world or at your workplace or certainly in the mission field, maybe even your family system. Jesus himself promised that at some point along the way, we'll all find ourselves at our own Jerusalems. Our response to these situations, however, is critical if we're to be an effective witness to God's life-changing power. Through Paul's example in Jerusalem, we learn, first of all, that it's important to accept the situation as God ordains it. Facing opposition never caused Paul to be unfaithful to God's plan. He had known that he would face hostility upon arriving at Jerusalem. But he calmly accepted that as God's will and refused to, like, run away. How easy it would have been for him to rationalize not going at all. Hey, I can minister better as a free person. My friends need me. I'm not sure about all that trouble. Had he done that, no one would have criticized him. They probably would have come alongside of him and pat him on the back and whispered, you know what, good choice. I certainly understand. But at a deeper level, discouragement and regret would have wreaked havoc, I believe, in the apostle's soul. Like a thief in the night, compromise would have set in and subtly eaten away like leaven his passion for the Lord's ministry. That's usually what happens when we choose to neglect our true calling. Paul couldn't allow that to happen. He had to meet his Jerusalem. And in whatever form that may take for us, so must we. Secondly, it's important to view each troubling circumstance as an opportunity. The crowd had not gathered to hear Paul preach or to break bread with him. You know, they gathered to annihilate his integrity. Paul used that occasion, however, to proclaim how God's saving power transformed his life. So let your light shine. Keep it real. Speak in their language. Those who are living in conflict may just find a way out as a result of God working in them through you. Finally, and I think most importantly, it's critical that we maintain the proper attitude, one of selfless love. It was Paul's love for others that took him into that troubling place. And yet he didn't retaliate, but took positive steps to clear up any misunderstandings. Above all, he wanted to help others resolve their hostility and trust Christ as he had done. We, on the other hand, might be tempted to put on a martyr's sackcloth, indulge a little self-pity, pull out our battle fatigues. But the right response is to face our accusers with a loving heart, an option that is only possible, if we ourselves have cast ourselves in the nail-scarred hands of Christ. Are you facing opposition this morning? Are you in the midst of your own Jerusalem, encountering hostility from those you love the most? If so, my prayer for you this morning is that you allow Paul's example, this great example, to guide your heart and your responses to the glory of God. Let's pray.